This week on Making Contact.
You're joined by hundreds of people throughout California here to win the AB889 Domestic Worker Bill of Rights.
Water is splashing over the seawalls at the tip of Lower Manhattan. Widespread flooding is the biggest concern in the nation's largest city as Hurricane Sandy approaches.
It's widely reported that drones are being used in drone strikes, and I support that entirely.
On this edition, we look back at some of the most compelling stories we brought you in 2012, from domestic workers struggling for respect to the consequences of climate change to drone warfare, and we'll find out where things are headed for 2013. Gian, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. In January 2012, hundreds marched in Sacramento, California, to advocate the passage of AB 889, a Domestic Workers Bill of Rights, which aimed to close existing gaps in labor laws with protections like meal and rest breaks, adequate sleeping conditions, and overtime pay. The California bill was inspired by a similar bill passed in New York State in 2010. California's legislature passed the bill, but by September, Governor Jerry Brown had vetoed it, disappointing thousands of domestic workers and their allies. But while California's Domestic Workers Bill of Rights failed to make it onto the books, the momentum it generated is now fueling efforts at similar legislation in other states, including Illinois, Washington, Massachusetts, and Hawaii. Domestic workers have historically been overlooked in the labor movement, and many see them as unorganizable. But this growing movement for domestic workers' rights looks outside the traditional union model, and in the process may change the face of labor organizing in the U.S. Reporter Megan LaSala explored these issues for Making Contact earlier this year.
This momentum for workers' rights comes as the issue of home care is growing. As the baby boomer generation retires, 10,000 people turn 65 every day, and more women in the workforce are relying on nannies to care for their children. Workers want to ensure that this growing industry provides quality jobs, but some say that these changes will make home care unaffordable. Sandy Levine owns a branch of Senior Helpers, an agency that provides in-home care in Alameda County, California. She argues that legally requiring things like overtime pay and rest breaks don't make sense for this industry.
Domestic workers get rest as their clients get rest, and many of them, they're going to rest in the afternoon or have a break then. Nobody's going to come in and be able to relieve them and give them an actual break. That's not the situation.
She points out that most people pay for care out of pocket, and she worries that the bill would make already expensive care unaffordable. She says her business already operates on a very tight profit margin.
This is going to be a very difficult situation, or almost impossible for seniors to be able to pick up the slack and the cost of what would happen in this industry if this passes.
I really don't believe it's going to be expensive for folks.
Jessica Lehman is a disability rights advocate and employs attendants in her home. She says that the bill shouldn't make care unaffordable.
If somebody is used to having a 12-hour or 24-hour shift, they will need to split that shift up into less than 8-hour shifts. And I know firsthand that hiring new attendants and training new attendants can be difficult, but I also know firsthand that it's possible, and we all know it's possible.
Jessica is an organizer with Hand in Hand, the Domestic Employers Association. Employer support played a key role in passing the New York Bill of Rights. So after that success, employers began to organize nationally with the belief that rights for workers are mutually beneficial for employers. Danielle Ferris is the director of Hand in Hand.
People with disabilities, seniors, workers, immigrants all need to be at one table, recognizing that we have overlap in our communities and that our lives are intertwined.
With the success in New York, organizers are beginning to look beyond basic protections and state legislation to figure out how to re-envision a fair system on a national scale. How do you regulate work that happens in people's private homes?
Thank you for coming. We have a bevy of information for you tonight. We are going to talk about just the basic...
It's a Monday evening, and about a dozen young parents crowd into a room in Brooklyn. They're here for an info session on how to hire a nanny, organized by Park Slope Parents, a neighborhood parenting group. there's more on the agenda than how to find the right fit and how much to pay. Topics also include work agreements, severance packages, and whether to provide health insurance. Sarah Sternad works with Jews for Racial and Economic Justice, one of the groups presenting at the meeting. She brings up the issue of providing health insurance for employees.
We recognize that not everyone in this room might even have their own health insurance, so what we're putting out there is a really big leap forward. But there are a couple of models out there that look like they might be feasible, and we want to start exploring how bits and pieces of those different models might be applicable to the Park Slope neighborhood and for people who want to try to be creative about being able to provide that really important benefit for their nanny or house cleaner.
Park Slope parents and other local groups offer one potential model for organizing employers, a key puzzle piece in figuring out how collective bargaining might work.
We really talk about the right to organize. And of course, what that means in this country is collective bargaining and the right to form a union and have a contract.
Ai-Jen Poo is the director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, a coalition of domestic worker organizations around the country.
The best defense for working people from unscrupulous employers, corporate greed, is really unions.
She acknowledges, though, that some of the changes that domestic workers are proposing might seem unimaginable.
But that doesn't mean we shouldn't pay people and we shouldn't offer them benefits. What that means is that there's something off balance in the system. We have to figure out how to fix it.
For Making Contact, I'm Megan LaSalla.
That report was filed back in February when the California Bill of Rights was being proposed. We asked Jill Schenker, field director for the National Domestic Worker Alliance, what lessons could be learned from California.
Organize, 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 right? We're building, this movement has been incredibly powerful because of the leadership of domestic workers and in partnership with great employers who have also been really supporting the bill throughout the process, employers of nannies, employers of personal attendants and caregivers for their parents, and people who really understand that the quality of care in their home depends a lot on the quality of work environment that they create, and that the society that we're trying to build is one in which we can all live with dignity.
From Walmart workers to fast food workers, 2012 saw an upsurge in organizing outside of the traditional labor movement. Schenker says that domestic workers are playing their part in this new effort.
We've built a Congress called the United Workers Congress, bringing together domestic workers with other workers who are excluded by law or by practice from the right to organize and basic labor protections in this country. It includes day laborers, formerly incarcerated workers, people who are working through welfare, guest workers and taxi drivers and restaurant workers, a whole array of sectors of workers that are organizing in, as you say, non-traditional labor formations. And unfortunately, we're seeing more and more attack on the traditional labor movement through right-to-work laws passing in Michigan and other places. And we all are part of needing to defend the right to organize for all workers in this country and needing to envision a labor movement that really addresses the kind of contingent position that more and more workers are in. We often say that more and more work looks more and more like domestic work. More and more people are working in isolated conditions. They're working odd hours, odd jobs, without consistent employment, without an ongoing contract. And how do we as a country and as a global labor movement really build something that can represent workers and workers' interests in that context? And so that's absolutely growing and a question that we're engaged in with sectors beyond domestic workers.
That was Jill Schenker of the National Domestic Worker Alliance. We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the US, Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Hurricane Sandy hit the East Coast in late October of this year, taking 200 lives and causing an estimated $65 billion in damages. Along with massive amounts of rain and cyclone-strength winds, the storm carried climate change back into the public consciousness. The nation had not seen such a storm since Katrina hit the Gulf Coast in 2005. Since Katrina, New Orleans has been developing new systems to make the city more resilient to natural disasters. Freelance producer Zoe Sullivan reported on some of these techniques back in March. Here's an excerpt from that show.
Severe weather cycles in summer and winter, hurricanes, tornadoes, and blizzards, along with greater temperature extremes, are becoming the new normal. As a result, more cities, on and off the coasts, are facing increased threats of flooding and are looking for ways to cope. Louisiana, with its long experience with floods, has the potential to pioneer solutions that can help cities across the U.S. and around the world.
You know, we're moving the fight out to the perimeter.
Paul Floro is a consultant with the Army Corps of Engineers.
Stopping the storm surge, not allowing it to come back into the heart of the city like we saw it during Katrina, and fighting it out here at Lake Bourne and in the Gulf.
Floro spoke at the Bayou Bienvenue Gate, a massive structure that was built by the Corps to stop rushes of water pushed by hurricanes. This is just one of many barriers that the Corps has built in the New Orleans area. The total Hurricane and Risk Reduction System package is worth more than $14 billion. Critics say Louisiana's project is not going to be effective. Author and River Basin expert John Barry is one of them.
I'm pretty confident that the system will do what it's supposed to do. The real problem is that what it's supposed to do is not very much. And it's supposed to protect against a storm with a 1% chance of arriving in any given year. And it's so-called 100-year storm, which gives people a false sense of security.
Barry says that the probability of a 100-year storm is actually much greater than 1 out of 100. And this discrepancy leads to planning decisions with problematic underlying assumptions that can cause further environmental damage and worsen the spiral. What's more, Barry says, enormous walls aren't the only way to protect Louisianans.
You know, there are three legs to the stool. The first is rebuilding the outer barrier, coastal marsh and so forth, which breaks down the wave energy. The second leg is, of course, the levees and flood walls that hold water out. The third leg, and which practically nobody's paid any attention to, is in, you know, what happens inside the city. And that's wholly within, you know, that's not the federal government. That's wholly within the purview of the city.
Although subsidies were offered to residents to elevate their homes following Hurricane Katrina, those funds were limited, and not everyone was able to take advantage of them. But even so, the city hasn't issued new building codes, which would force property owners to raise their structures. One of the more radical proposals involves allowing the Mississippi River to change its course. While it may represent a huge shift for area residents, it reflects what nature would do if left to itself. Denise Reed teaches coastal ecology at the University of New Orleans.
And the best thing we can do is re-divert the river. The best thing we can do is get the water and the sediment out of the river during a flood and get it out into the coast to start building land. We can't catch it in any other way except with the natural way that sediment gets captured in a delta. We can't put a big piece of cheesecloth across the river and catch it. The way that nature builds deltas is with high water during floods. That is the process that we need to replicate in other areas.
Reed is one scientist who espouses managing the river in a way that allows it to build up land by flooding. Some steps are being taken in this direction, but coastal experts estimate that under the current plans, it'll take 30 years before the Delta will stop losing land and begin to rebuild. One firm has drafted a design for the city that would create a circulating water system with canals. David Wagoner has been the driving force behind this plan.
The city of New Orleans would look more like a garden city. We talk in the Garden District, but you know, if you imagined a wet, subtropical garden city, you know, with flowing water and frogs croaking at night and less mosquitoes because the frogs eat the mosquitoes, you'd be in a natural city. You'd be in a what the Europeans would say an ecological city, you know, not just a hard man-made city. But you'd have beautiful buildings too, more trees, but with open water.
Wagoner and Reed's proposals are two ideas about how Louisiana can reshape its relationship with the environment, but their implications reach beyond the bayou.
We have places like Shanghai, and we have places like London, and let's not forget Manhattan. And so this is not just a problem for Louisiana. This is not just a problem for Venice. It's a problem for many, many of these megacities around the world. They all have places that are low-lying next to the water. But the incremental rise of sea level means that in the long run, we're going to have to pay attention. And so the sooner we can learn these lessons, the better.
Zoe Sullivan brought us that report from New Orleans. Making Contact caught up with Denise Reed, now chief scientist at the Water Institute of the Gulf, in December, in the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy.
I think there really has been a change in the conversation since Sandy, partly because the great surprise it was to so many that such an event of flooding lower Manhattan and other very heavily populated areas could happen. Obviously, scientifically, people were very aware that it could happen. But it hadn't really happened in anybody's lifetime. It wasn't a vivid memory for anybody. That's actually quite different when you think about the flooding of New Orleans in Katrina. Many people who experienced the flooding in Katrina remembered themselves, not just hearing stories from their parents, Hurricane Betsy in 1965. And so to some extent, I think flooding down here in the Gulf Coast was something that we expect. Obviously, the magnitude of something like Katrina is not really expected, but it's part of living here. It hadn't become part of living in the New York metropolitan area. I think now people will realize that that is the kind of thing that the future holds, and holds for many, many places, not just those places like the Gulf Coast where we expect that kind of flooding to occur.
Reed also spoke of the need for a diversity of solutions for the many places that will be affected by rising sea levels.
If we think about what kinds of actions we should take in coastal areas, because flooding is going to happen, then it doesn't always mean we have to build something. It might mean we have to change the way we go about our daily lives. It might mean we have to raise some structures. It might mean we have to move some others. In some instances, we might decide that building some kind of protective wall is the best thing to do. There's no one-size-fits-all for coastal adaptation, though. We have to think about what we need to do at the coast. Some of the things that we do at the coast, they depend on being at the coast. Major port facilities for global trade, for instance. You can't relocate those to higher land. They have to be down by the water. And so we have to think about the things that really need to be down by the water that are inevitably going to be subject for flooding. They might have a different solution to some of the kinds of activities that we currently do now by the coast, just because the coast is a nice place to be.
Reed says she remains hopeful that solutions can be found and implemented, even in the face of the inevitable rise in sea levels.
It may seem after the event, like it's too little, too late. I've already flooded, my house has already been destroyed. But really, we can't go back and change the past. All we can do is better prepare for the future. And I have to be optimistic that we understand enough about how these coastal systems work. We've learned a lot of lessons from the things we've done wrong in the past, and that we will finally be able to put a suite of solutions together in different places, in different configurations, that will allow us still to work and live and play at the coast.
finally, in 2012, we brought you the stories of people living under U.S. drone attacks. No one knows how many people have been targeted by these unmanned aerial vehicles, but drone strikes have been reported in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Yemen, and their use is growing. The U.S. government refuses to talk about the program, but there are hundreds of stories from survivors of drone attacks, like this one from North Waziristan.
It was 3 o'clock in the morning. 8 people died in the attack, and all of them were local people. We were all together in the Hujra, which is a traditional guest house for men. No one knows where the drone hit. We only witnessed the destruction. We found small pieces of the bodies after the attack. We gathered the pieces into a sack and buried them. There was a huge blast. I heard a roaring sound, and that was all. The drone hit a room, and nothing outside of the room got damaged, but the room collapsed. Americans do not differentiate between the bad and the good. They use drones and kill people, even if they are innocent. My guests were neither foreign militants, nor were they local Pakistani Taliban militants. So why would I expect a drone attack at my place? I believe both Pakistan and the USA are responsible, but none of the dead are enemies of the US or Pakistan. We do feel worried and afraid, but we are poor people. Where can we go from here? We can't afford to live anywhere else. It is up to the Americans if they want to leave us alive or if they want to kill us. It is all up to the Americans, as we can't move out from the area.
In 2013, we'll be bringing you a special show that looks at how law enforcement agencies in the U.S. are bringing drones to the skies of American cities. Making Contact's Lisa Redman spoke with Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink and author of Drone Warfare: Killing by Remote Control, about the growing drone industry.
As far as the buying and the selling of the technology and the equipment, what corporations are involved?
The corporation that's most known for the killer drones, the Predator and Reaper drones, is General Atomics, which is in Southern California. Originally founded by an Israeli engineer who worked for the Israeli military, came to the United States, started his own company that got sold and then got sold again and became General Atomics. There's a smaller company in California known as Aero Environment that's producing a lot of the small drones and uses this biomimicry to take the beauty of nature and try to replicate it and turn it into drones. And then there's the usual, the big guys on the block, and that's the Raytheon and the Boeing and the Northrop Grumman. They are making drone parts. They're making the sensors for the drones. They're making new missiles to strap onto the drones. Everybody wants a piece of the drone pie. And now, since there are so many different kinds of drones, just about every single weapons company is involved in drone productions. I think when they heard the Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, say drones were the only game in town, they wanted to make sure they were part of the game.
And it sounds like it's a growth market. Can you give us a sense of the scale of you know, what sort of scale is this industry and where's it going?
It's about a $6 billion industry right now, and it's planned to double by 2018, and will probably just keep doubling every couple of years because there's so many potential uses for drones. And, you know, we should be clear that there's good drones and bad drones. And in the potential for good drones, there's all kinds of things that commercial groups want to use drones for. Real estate agents want to use them for surveilling land. Post offices might use them for delivering the mail, as well as all kinds of messenger services. Farmers want to use them for spraying their crops, and cattle ranchers want to use them for finding their cattle. And there are restaurants that have talked about using them to deliver your lunch, although they can't figure out how to keep it warm or to keep you from stealing their drone once you got the lunch. So there's all kinds of potentials. And then there's environmentalists who use drones to catch whalers on the high seas, Brazilian government using drones to catch illegal logging in the Amazon, forest fighters trying to use drones to pin down where the fire is coming from. So there's all those potential uses. But what is driving the drone industry right now is the killing and the spying. And it's in the spying where the drone manufacturers see tremendous possibilities. They would love to see every police department in the United States have at least a drone, if not a fleet of drones. And you can imagine all these private detectives, they would all love drones. I mean, you could watch your husband, your wife, your boyfriend, your girlfriend. I mean, there's all kinds of things you could do to spy on people with drones.
So what's holding back the further proliferation? And tell us more about the drone lobby and the drone caucus. You've used those terms. Could you sort of talk about that?
The drone manufacturers, although they compete with each other, they also understand the capitalist way is you come together as a lobby while you're competing with each other. And that lobby has become a very powerful lobby. And they do what lobbies do. They go to Congress. They go to the White House. They push their issues. But they've been so successful in the case of Congress that they managed to get 58 members of Congress, mostly Republicans, but also Democrats, including some liberal Democrats, to join a caucus. And it says in the mission statement that the job of that caucus is to push the urgent need to push for the further deployment of unmanned aerial vehicles, both overseas and in the United States, for law enforcement and commercial ends. So this drone caucus has written new legislation, passed it through Congress, signed by the Obama administration, February 14th of 2012, Valentine's Day, a big present for the drone industry, to say that you must start issuing lots and lots and lots, thousands of permits for drones. And the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA, has been reluctant because they know the drones crash. There's nobody up in the sky that's looking around to see who else is up in the sky. And so there have been billions of dollars that are now being put into retooling the industry so that drones can be incorporated into our airspace by the end of September at 2015 at the latest, and before that for law enforcement agencies. So right now we have police stations, they're experimenting with drones. FBI has drones, Border Security has drones, Homeland Security has drones. But this is still in the experimental stage. And unless we do something about it, we are going to see tens of thousands of drones in our own airspace, many of them used to spy and surveil the American people.
That was Medea Benjamin, author of Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control, speaking with Making Contact's Lisa Rudman. That's it for this edition of Making Contact. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736 or check out our website, radioproject.org, to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Like Making Contact on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Andrew Stelzer and George Lavender producers, Irene Flores, web editor, Lisa Bartfai, Salima Hamirani, and Aaron Mathewson, production interns, and Barbara Barnett, Dan Turner, and Alton Bird, volunteers. I'm Jen Cheehan, and thanks for listening to Making Contact.